Welcome to A New Lens with Common Good Capital, where we talk with investors, RIAs, fund managers, and philanthropists about their experiences within different impact investing themes, as well as explore the power of stewardship and capital. I'm your host, Jeff Schaefer, CEO of Common Good Capital, and I am here today with Jean-Vier. Jean-Vier, how do you say your last name?
Gamige.
Whoa. So we're going to call you Jean-Vier. But ironically, he's also known as Mike, and maybe you'll tell us that story. It was not, yeah. He did not name himself Mike just to be here in the United States. And so we can talk about it in a little bit here.
That's right.
And Jean-Vier is from Kigali, Rwanda, which is obviously why we're chatting today, because in fact, just earlier today, I was talking to my brother who is in Rwanda. So I think you're going to find that his story is quite remarkable. In fact, we met maybe a month ago at the Winter Park Art Festival here in Winter Park. He was selling, and what do you call Rwandan baskets?
Woven basket.
So he was selling woven baskets that are from Rwanda, and I'm sure we'll talk about that in a little bit. So we struck up a conversation because we have a bunch of them that we actually had purchased when we were in Rwanda. So let me just tell you, he studied finance at Kigali Independent University. He's married and has a four-month-old son, and they live in Lewisville, Texas. Did I say that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Just north of Dallas. I'll just say this. It's not every day that we go to a market. In this case, it's an artist show that comes to Winter Park, I think once, twice a year. I don't know that my wife and I have ever met somebody there and then have them over for dinner. But Jean-Vier, that's exactly what we did. So, and I knew once we started chatting, we need to get you on this podcast. So sorry to pontificate so long, but welcome. And we're grateful to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm going to start in a spot I don't normally start, but I'm looking at you here on screen. And this is what drew us together, whatever it was, a month ago. Tell us about these woven baskets. What are these woven baskets about from Rwanda? What's the significance of them, and why are you making them?
The woven baskets, they are like my family, my culture, history. When I was like young, I used to see everybody in my family, they were weavers. And also they were woven to be functional and also to be decorative.
As I know it, Rwanda is the only place that these types of baskets are made, other than, you told me, one place in the United States. Give us a little background on that idea.
Baskets are everywhere. They are from everywhere. When you are here, there are many like Navajo baskets, Mexican baskets. They're like, baskets are everywhere. What makes them different is the material and the history behind. When I moved here, I found out that there are people in South Carolina. They are called Gala, and they make baskets. And surprisingly, they use the same material as the ones made in Rwanda, which is surprisingly, they are the only ones that are made in the same materials.
And so what are those materials?
Sweet grass.
Sweet grass. Okay. So what we'll do is we'll put a link so people can see what these baskets look like. Okay. So let's go back. Tell us, where did you grow up? I'll do this in chunks. Normally I ask this in one big question, but let's just, to make this simple.
Sure.
Tell us where you grew up, and then a little bit of snapshot of your life until you came to the United States.
I was born and raised in Rwanda. I was born in the west of Rwanda, in a small city called Rusizi. It's on the border of Rwanda and DRC Congo. I grew up there, and my family, and then we moved in Kigali in 2000. Yeah, we lived in different area in Kigali. As your brother living there, if I say Kimirongo, he will know what I'm talking about.
Okay.
All of my school, I started there. My high school, I went to, it was in the north of Rwanda. And that's where I did my high school. And this is not common, especially in Rwanda. I only did 6 years in one school.
Okay.
My 6 years, I spent them in one school, which is not common in Rwanda because we do have like first 3 years. Usually we start those 3 years in one school, and then the rest 3 years we go on another school. But for me, because I used to play soccer, so the school, they wanted me to stay there and study and then play for them.
So then when you were growing up, what did you want to do when you became of age?
That's a good question. I was raised by a single mother because of the history, the genocide that happened in 1994 in Rwanda. Took my father. When the genocide happened, I was 7 years old. My mom taught me I was the man of the house.
And so at 7 years old, you became the man of the house.
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah. And from that time, my mom used to tell me, hey, it's me and you. And I have my two young brothers. She used to say, it's me and you. We have to raise your brothers. And from that time, I became a man of the house. At that time, it was uncommon in Rwanda to find a single mother raising three kids. So everybody used to say, she's never gonna raise them right. They used to say she will leave us. They used to say so many things. They used to say we'll never be men, because it was uncommon to see a single mother raising kids, because usually, because of culture, men were the one who were providers for the family, yep, their families. And they never seen a mother providing for their families.
Now, was that the way it was pre-genocide or even after genocide?
It was both ways.
Wow.
Pre and after. When I was like 10 years, and my mom used to hear those stories, she'll cry, she'll tell us what people say, what people think. And as me, thinking I'm the man of the house, I used to feel like I have to comfort her, I have to take care of her, and I have to be there for her. And it made me be exactly the man of the house. It made me think, hey, what I have to do, I have to prove all of those people wrong.
Mm.
So I started to train myself to be a nice kid. Even though sometimes, we'll go to play and then we go home late a little bit. But I trained myself to be a perfect kid, but not because I wanted to be a perfect kid, but I wanted to prove those people who says we'll never be men, we'll never be raised right. I wanted to prove them wrong.
I'm assuming you had other friends that were in similar situations as you. Did all these young men respond in the same way that you responded? Because you don't have to respond that way. You could be very bitter and go a different direction. So why did you go the way that you went? And what did you observe other young men your age? I mean, I can't even call you a young man at 7 to 10 years. I mean, it's just crazy. But did you see others go down a different path?
I saw that. I'll also say, because my mom, she was a Christian, she empowered us with positive, even though the situation was a little bit hard, she'll tell us a little bit of kindness can change everything. That's why, like, I was positive about it, but I know there are others that were negative or discouraged, never made it to school, and maybe they ended up being bad, going to the streets, do drugs or everything. But me, because of my mom, taught us how to pray, how to believe in God, in like 7 from 8, 10. So I knew how to praise God when I was at the age of 10. Because I mentioned I only had two young brothers. And also it was not common to see a son or a mayor clean a house. It was culturally, it was the work of women. So me, myself, I would clean the house, I would cook, I would do everything. Everybody was surprised how I turned the situation. I didn't care about what they say to see like me cleaning and after go to school, me cooking. It never discouraged me because I was looking to prove that my mom, she's raising us right and she's doing all she can.
You became the man of the house at an age before anybody should be forced to be the man of the house. Mm-hmm. So then what did, I mean, after you graduated from high school and your life after that, were you able to dream and think about that? Or were you just focused on the here and now?
I thought about it and it made me to be humble and to focus on the brighter future. Because as I mentioned, my mom was, she's a believer, she's a Christian. We believe that God will change the situation, which he did.
I could go down that path for a long time because, you know, I just look at my own life and, but I mean, and not even comparing it to you all, but my gosh, to have your father and their other family members who passed away.
Yeah.
Or
yes.
I mean, frankly, were murdered.
Many, yeah.
How do you not become bitter at God?
At one point, because I was very young, I didn't know what it was, but I believed my mom's energy. She was very kind and she taught us to be kind. So one example, I went to school with, like my father was killed with by his best friend. So I went to school. That best friend, he had his son with the same age. So we had to share same school. Sometime I was angry. I couldn't even say hi to him because I knew they didn't like us. They didn't love us because his father killed my father. But I became to the point where, thanks to my mom, she taught us to forgive. Yeah. And she used to say, if you forgive, it's not you forgiving him or them. It's actually forgiving yourself or giving yourself a chance to live, to be able to live. She used to say, you are forgiving them to be able to live, to be able to release that burden. Me not becoming bitter or angry to God, it was, if I become bitter to God, I will never be able to praise him, to worship him. For those people that killed my family, I forgave them for me to be able to live, for me to be able to continue to go to school, for me to be able to release myself, to be free.
Jean-Pierre, I got to believe there's a lot listening today who say, I don't know how to do that. I don't know how one does that. So all I can say is hearing it from your lips, who has been wronged by your best friend's dad, speaks a truth that if I tried to explain it 100 times, nobody's going to get it because you got to hear it from your lips. And so thank you for sharing that. And God bless you for being able to actually live in that realm. And obviously you're living proof that it creates freedom for you.
Yes.
But it's amazing how many people say, I don't care, I still wouldn't do it.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Let's jump forward a little bit here. So you did go to school in Rwanda to do what?
In high school, I did accounting for 3 years.
Okay.
And then after I went to university or college, and I did 4 years in finance. When I grew up, I used to love working in bank, to be a bank.
Yeah, working in a bank, yeah.
Mm-hmm. First of all, because those people... Not only, I never thought of like money, only because they were smart. They looked smart. And for that reason, I loved to work in the bank.
Interesting. So it was more the persona of them looking smart, professional, together.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, less about the money side of it. Interesting. All right. So then what brought you here to the United States?
When I was in Rwanda, I have family here. My cousin, he was a friend to my wife's brother. So when my wife will come to Rwanda, we'll meet and as my cousin's family friends, and he will say, "You take care of Aline." And from there, so my family was a friend, were friends to my wife's family. And then from there, we started dating, and before we even knew it.
So you've been married how long?
5 years.
What are you, about 35-ish?
Yep.
So 35-ish. So you live in the United States. You are making these baskets as your income and your livelihood today, just to set the context. Mm-hmm. How would you describe who you are in the context of where you are at in this larger life journey that you're on?
That's very deep.
You can think about it if you need to.
Yeah. I see myself as someone who is always trying to help others, always being of service. It gave me joy. When I was in high school, I rescued a girl. I think when I remember that, it gave me purpose and shows me who I am and who I want to be in the future. I see myself as someone who is always at service or serving others.
So do you see yourself going back to Rwanda at some point? And if service is what drives you, do you have any sense of what that would service could look like in the future?
I see myself going back to Rwanda, not because I'm a United States citizen now. Mm. So I have both citizen at some point because of the way I believe or the way I feel God, like my calling,
yep,
which is to be able to help others, to love others. So I think me living here is creating wealth or capital, growing professionally. And at some point, one day, I'll go back to Rwanda to help or to be at service. And when I say to be at service is help others financially, personal growth, friends and families.
Connecting dots, you obviously had a mother who modeled that for you.
Yes, absolutely.
In fact, your mom is still alive, right?
Yes, she's still alive.
All right. So one of these days when Shelly and I go back to Rwanda to visit my brother and do some due diligence, I want to meet your mom.
That would be lovely.
She clearly has raised an amazing young man.
I appreciate it.
One of the questions that I was going to ask you is, how are you trying to change the world? You can answer that if you want. But mm-hmm. I do think if you're willing to explain, articulate a little bit more of the story that you just mentioned about saving a young girl. If you just isolated that one thing, you've lived a meaningful life, but obviously you've got more than that. So share with us a little bit about the story about how you saved this young girl. And I'm going to preface it because I've sat and heard the story. This is not a story you normally talk about.
Yeah.
And I know that it's not a story that you share bragging about what you've done. Instead, you were at the right place at the right time. Yeah. And you listen to a voice to move forward and help somebody. So I just want that to come through for our listeners, because I know you're going to explain the story, but I know that you're not sharing it just to go, "Hey, look at me at what I did."
Yeah.
And I'm going to say one other thing. So what was interesting when Jean-Pierre was at our house, one of the things that we do, and this is through my brother, we have a fund where we're investing in renewable energy assets in East Africa. And one of the projects that we are looking at acquiring there's a solar farm that sits on an orphanage. Turns out this orphanage, I mentioned the name to you, and you absolutely knew the name of this orphanage because it has a school on it. And the way we backed in the story is this this young lady who you saved, you would love her to go and get into the school. So then you said, I got to tell you the story. So tell us a story about how you were in the right place at the right time and listen to that still small voice to make a difference.
I remember I was in my last year of high school.
So you're 18-ish?
Yeah, 18, 17-ish, yeah. It was at 8 p.m. We were in study hall.
So you were at a boarding school, just to be clear.
Yes, I was. Yeah, yes. Okay. We were in, it was a boarding school.
Okay.
Yeah. And what happened is we had police came into our school, which was not normal. Everybody got out to see what's going on, to go see what was happening at that time. We followed where the police was going. We found out it was going to girls' dormitory. They told us there was this young student that had a baby. Mm-hmm. And she threw the baby in the toilet. When I say toilet, it's not like these modern
United States, right?
Yes, no, they are different. What they did, they were creating a hole because it's those big hole.
So it's just a big hole.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and it's deep, way deep. And
so how deep is this big hole? 20 feet?
I think even more than that. Because let's say even 200-300 people go in to use that.
Okay, so it's got to be fairly deep to catch all the waste.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Are you hearing a baby cry? Is that?
Yes, yes. The baby is crying at that time, and they are making the hole bigger so that someone can go down. And it was at that time, it was 9:30-ish. The police and the leaders at the school, the headmaster, they were like, okay, we don't have to send someone else because obviously we don't want to lose a second person.
So it's too dangerous to put somebody else down there to go get the baby.
Yes. And which made sense because it's too deep and it's at night. They were unprepared. So they were like, the baby is going to die anyways. Mm-hmm. So let's not lose someone else. So they agreed on everybody, the authority and the police. They agreed on that. I could hear what they were talking about. I heard a voice. It's not like I had a voice as a voice.
Right.
In myself, in me.
Yeah.
It came to, like I couldn't even breathe. Me hearing them saying that they're going to let the baby die. Then I said, no. You didn't make the hole bigger, or you didn't spend all this time to let the baby die. Imagine I was 17, 18. The people I'm telling are all authorities and police.
So what voice did you hear inside your head?
I heard the courage. I had, like, I completely forgot myself. And I focused on rescuing the baby. I focused on, the baby can die. I felt like I could not live if the baby died. In myself, I felt like, nope, you gotta do it, you can do it. And I remember myself confronting the authorities. Obviously, it was not me. Convincing.
So what did you tell them?
I said, no, you didn't do all of this to let the baby die. I can do it. Just like that. Then they refused. Everybody said, no, you can't. I remember there was, because I played soccer, there was a leader, he was in charge of education. There was another one who was in charge of discipline, all of those. He said, actually, he can do it because when we are not scoring, he always come and score.
So literally, he's saying, I've seen him in sport.
Yes.
And in soccer. And I know his character. I know he can do it. When nobody else can do it, he can do it.
Yes. That's what he said. Exactly. That's what he said.
Wow.
Only him saying that, the police was like, oh, he started to touch me to feel if I'm strong enough. And I was like, yeah, I play soccer and I can do it. So then they agreed, okay, if he's offering and he's refusing, then let's try, let's take a chance. Because the baby was crying all the time. All that time, the baby was still crying. They kind of like brought like ropes, very long ropes. So they zipped me everywhere. And then they put me down in the hole.
And so this hole, is it much wider than your body?
So when you go in, it's small. After you passed that top. So
then it gets wider as it goes down.
Yes. Yeah.
The stench, the smell. Are you thinking about it? It's got to be disgusting.
Oh, yeah. It was actually, there was a lot of gas.
Oh, gas in there. Yeah.
Yes. Which was the most dangerous, because even kind of burned my skin.
Oh, burned your skin.
Mostly, yeah. Mostly in the face. I went down. I got the baby and I rescued her. And when I got up,
So just to be clear, the baby is laying in human excrement.
Yes.
Wow.
What I did, I put her, and then they put me, because I was zipped with the ropes. So they put, our school was closed like 10 minutes to the hospital, which was at that time was uncommon. You know
that you were that close to the hospital?
Yes. Yeah. The school was that close to the hospital. Usually you even go 30 minutes.
Yeah,
which was luck to be able to be closer to the hospital. So I got the baby out because me and the baby was, we were in the dirt. So
yeah,
it's me who were able to take the baby to the hospital. So I took her, and then I remember the police. He didn't care as well. I don't remember him because he was kind of like first. So what he did, he was like, okay, come. And there was those big motorcycles, the police. Okay. So he put me and the baby on the motorcycle. We went straight to the hospital. And they called to the hospital. And they let them know that we are coming. We need emergency help. And then when I got there, it was like 11 p.m. ish. I was there, and then it said, you gotta save this baby. I was kind of like commanding, but I don't think I was in charge. God was in charge, you know? And I remember telling them, hey, you gotta save this baby. Everybody, please do all you can to save the baby. The baby was saved. They found the mom because the mom, she was young. She didn't know what she was doing. She didn't know anything. And I think she was afraid of the family. She kind of hid it to her family. And at the school, after it happened, so they went to search who was the mother. They finally found her, and then they took her to the hospital as well. Long story short, they took the mom and then the baby. They took the mom to the prison, of course. Uh-huh. And the baby was in the prison with her mom. After the baby was 3 years, so she got out. And I heard the baby got out. I went to see the baby after all those years. And I was done because I was at my last year at high school. So I was in the university at that time. I went back to see the baby. When I saw the baby, I don't know what happened to me. I cried and I felt she was my own. Mm. Yeah, I cried a lot and I held her and I gave her my names.
So she has your last name?
She has my first name, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she has, you know, because Janvier is French.
Right.
And Janvier, it's Janvier is male, and then Janvier is female.
Female, okay.
Yeah. So at that time, I didn't even know last name, first name, I said Janvier. So I came up with that. And I didn't give her my last name, but I gave her another name called, it's a Kinyarwanda name. Yeah. It's called Izibyose, which means God knows all.
God knows all.
Yes. So I came up with those names. And from that, took her to school from that moment up to now.
You have adopted her, not in the sense of an American adoption, no legal papers, yes, but you've internally taken upon yourself to help her however you can, mm-hmm, throughout her life at this point. Is that the right way to say it?
Yes, that's the right way. What I did, I was like, okay, you know, obviously, she was living with her auntie. No, actually, her mom's auntie.
Okay. Yeah,
her mom's auntie. At that point, they were in the village. They were poor. So when I looked at the situation, I was like, no, I gotta take her to at least a little bit nicer school. And which surprisingly, this young lady, ever since, she's always number one in school. She's always, I don't know how I can describe it, but she's very smart, very smart.
So how often do you speak to her today?
Now she's in boarding school. She's in high school. Mostly when there is a visit, because there is every 3 weeks at her school, there is a visit. Parents go to visit their kids. So we try to talk, and mostly we talk when she's in vacation.
Does she know this story?
Her mother's auntie, she brought that question because she didn't know the story. They wanted to tell her, but I said, no, it's still early. Don't tell her until she's done with high school. So she don't know the story.
I was chatting with somebody probably a month ago who does some nonprofit work in an African country, actually down south in South Africa. And we didn't talk about your story, but she has an orphanage today that young girls throwing babies into latrines there is not uncommon. Mm-hmm. And the situation there is HIV has wiped out a whole kind of generation. Is that a situation that's similar in Rwanda where babies end up on the roadside or wherever a lot?
At that time, because of the history, because of all of that, it was a little bit on a big percentage. But now, I don't know how common it is. You see young kids on the street for sure, whether their moms abandon them or their parents. But I would say, yeah, you can find kids on the street, mostly because of poverty.
I don't know how to make the transition to another topic, but before we do that, is there anything else you would want our listeners to know? Or if your adopted daughter were to happen to listen, was there anything you'd want her to know?
I would want her to know that I'm proud of her. And I know God has a big purpose on her life because based on what she went through, I believe God rescued her. And I believe the way she's very smart in school, the way she's doing, I can see her change the world. Yeah, I'll tell her whether, I don't know, maybe in a couple of years in the future, when she listens or when she finds this podcast, she knows that I love her very, very much.
Well, it was very clear when we were chatting around at our house and you were sharing this story, there is a very unique bond and love that you have for her.
Yes.
And, you know, it's sad because you, well, there's blessing and curses. It's sad because you want every child to know and to feel that same love. And the irony to me is, I'm assuming you had it with your dad. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But did you ever fully, you didn't get to play that out as long as one should and as one as you would have liked to. Yet the love of your mom that instilled in you gave you enough gumption that you love and are serving others today. So it's a really amazing picture of like your upbringing. That's brutal. And you could have gone the other way. And yet in the midst of that, you had people who were there with you and spoken to you and loved you. And I got to believe you're a better person today. Not that you would ever will what happened to you, but it was you that got the message to say, you need to go save this girl. And it was you who listened and heeded the call. What an amazing and beautiful story of healingness in the middle of a very broken story, candidly. You know, and then one of the things that you had said to me when you were at our house is, you know, you have a deep calling for if I remember right, mothers who are widowers or young women as you go back to Rwanda someday. And so, again, the very thing that shaped you, you have a calling to make a difference in that. So I thank you for listening to that still small voice to go risk. And I know that you don't want credit for it. But on the other hand, you showed up, you took a risk. And frankly, I wish we all would do that. Let me switch gears. I don't know how you do that. You know, you come from a unique scenario. You're now here in the United States. You're an entrepreneur. You've got big plans yourself. So I want to switch to a topic that we talk about here on this podcast, and that's the power of capital. I'm leaving that broad on purpose.
Yeah.
So given your upbringing and then your life experiences, when did you recognize the power of capital, and what does the power of capital mean to you?
Wow, I like that question. I really love that question because based on my history, I've never seen, when you say capital, I've never seen the rich or the people who had a lot of money. I remember the person who taught me also. I have my auntie who lives in Canada that I love deeply. She taught me how to love my family. To help my family. She's the only one that I saw who had money. As I grew up, as I was finishing my studies, as I was trying to shape my career, who I want to be, what I want to do, that's when, after I found out that I can help myself by having a capital, enough capital, but also I found out that power of capital that I need or that I needed, it was to be able to help my family, especially my mom, my two young brothers, and family and others. So that's when I realized the power of capital. That's when I realized it would be the tool to help me to improve the lives of me, my family, and all those in need. And right now that I live here in the state, I even understand it more because I can do more with a little bit that God is providing for my family. And I can be able to share with my families.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm not so sure, not to be negative towards the United States, because there's a lot of wonderful things about the United States, but I think the United States is definitely a little bit more about me. And so hearing you immediately think about the power of capital and how it impacts you, your family, and your community, not to say that you don't find that here in the United States, but I'm not so sure that's always the first response that gets communicated. When you think of the word stewardship, so you go to the United States, there is a lot of wealth here, and clearly there's still poverty here. How do you think about stewardship? So, and maybe another way to say it is, I mean, you're kind of living it out. I mean, you are living it out. What does stewardship mean to you? How do you think about living that out?
When I look back, you know, in my life, I've never, maybe when I finished high school, that's when I worked for somebody. But ever since, when I was in college or university, first year, that's when I started my first business.
So you've been an entrepreneur?
Yes. Ever since up to now, I've been training myself to take a little bit, let's say resource, try to invest it in many different ways to be able to generate a passive income.
And have you mainly been doing that through other businesses, or do you also invest in the traditional sense of invest?
I also invest traditionally.
Okay. And where did you learn that?
My mom, she's never done business. I have my uncle, who is an entrepreneur for a long time. A little bit of story. He never went to school. But let me tell you, he's very smart. That one of the people who are doing really well in Rwanda, he's among those. If there is, let's say, 50 people who are doing really well, he's among them. But he never went to school. So when I try to look at the way he lives, the way he changing lives, so I would say I learned it from him.
Yeah, you just look at your life, as is all of us, but the family members, key individuals around you really have helped shape you into who you are today.
Yes.
From your mom, from your auntie to your uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And yet one would look at Rwanda when you grew up and you'd have to make a judgment call and go, my gosh, that whole place is decimated. Where do you, you know, look at the, I mean, that's probably one of the, unfortunately, one of the most hideous things that's ever happened. And yet still in the midst of that, light shone through and you're still living it today.
Yeah. I listened to your brother's talking about Rwanda and Africa. And mostly, like you said, when I see Africa, when I see Rwanda, I'm proud to be Rwandan.
Yeah.
The reason why is because when I look at the history, when I look at where Rwanda came from, when I look at, I know it's politic, but when I look at our president, Paul Kagame,
yep,
the way things were, but him and the others, the other group came and rescued us. Now they took Rwanda 29 years ago from scratch, because everything was complete down.
Mm-hmm.
Everything, schools, banks, people died, everything was done. So they took it to where it is right now. I'd say everything is possible.
Mm.
Now that I live here in this country, I learn a lot. To me, the way I see it, living here is a chance that God gave me to grow in all of areas of my life, to learn a lot. And then because of what God want me, or where God want me to be in the future, and then maybe go back and help to build or to improve Rwanda, but also the continent of Africa.
Mm-hmm. As somebody who grew up in Rwanda and, of course, lives in the United States, from your unique experience, what would you want to tell, what would you share with an average American, some wisdom and nuggets from just your life and the unique perspective that you've seen?
That's deep.
Yeah. And if you don't want to answer it, that's fine, too.
No, like you said, I grew up in Rwanda, all my life in Rwanda, but now I live here. But I'll tell like an average American to know how lucky to be American. I'm an American. How lucky it is to be an American.
And what do you mean by that?
It's a blessing to be able to go to school. And it's a blessing to be able to not think, what am I gonna eat tomorrow? It's a blessing to be able to have, let's say, for example, to not have war, to not never know war, you know, because I have lived war. I would tell them to be thankful.
And then what do you say to all the political energy that just fighting amongst each other? Do you any thoughts on that one?
I think everybody is looking for some same thing. Is to live a life. Back in my history, Rwandans killed Rwandans. Why? How did it start? I don't know. I was young, but the history, mm-hmm. it was political, hate one another, do this. But in the end, everybody wanted the same thing, peace and to live a life. So I would say, if you are looking for a solution, don't blame one another. Mm. Look for a solution and find, you can always go this way, I go this way, but always find the same solution.
So let me, and I can't believe I'm going to bring this up, but let me take one hot topic here in the United States, mm-hmm. that there's two very polarizing sides, and that's the whole, and I'm not going to say this politically correct, but that's the whole idea of a woman's right to choose or abortion. And so let me pontificate. If I just took what you just said, mm-hmm. it'd be hard pressed for me to find somebody who would say more abortion is good for anybody. Forget about which side you sit on here. Mm-hmm. We pretty much can agree the fewer abortions, the better. And so if we could almost just start at there, mm-hmm. recognizing we're probably not going to get agreement on everything, mm-hmm. but if overall, collectively, we are working on reducing the amount of abortions, which is a complicated issue, which is more than just the baby itself. It also has to do with the mother and poverty. But I mean, that's a rallying cry that everybody could get behind, even if at the nuances, we don't mm-hmm. agree with everything.
Yes.
Is that an example of what you mean? Go find some commonality and don't blame, and let's work on some solutions.
Yes. Yeah. That's what I meant. Always when you look, everybody's looking for the same thing, even though you can go different ways, but in the end, it's the better good of the country, of the citizen. And but when you start to blame one another, if I blame you and you blame me, then we forget what we were looking for, what solution we were trying to find.
Last question. Mm-hmm. If you could have any dream come true, what would it be?
I would maybe build more orphanages and parents those kids that don't have parents. That would be my dream.
Well, on that, Jean-Vier, I've got to say that it's been a pleasure to once again chat with you. Love your heart. You know, when I first walked up to you in Winter Park there was just something different. You had a big old smile on your face. And yet there's been some pretty challenging things you've been through. So yeah. thanks for being an example. Anything you want to say in closing?
I would say thank you very much. Usually I never met anyone like you. Like you said, we met and then it was a divine connection. And I've never done interview like this or podcast. I'm doing it and I'm happy. I think God bless you. May you continue to be the voice of those that don't have people that represent them.
It's an honor and pleasure to do what we do every day. I will say it's trying to change people's mindset that investing is an amazing gift. Mm-hmm. And it's a huge responsibility, but if you align your capital with your own values in trying to make the world a better place, it can be an unbelievably enriching experience. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, that message, I think people get it intellectually, mm-hmm. but to actually do it, they almost need somebody to give them the freedom to do it. Because yeah. everybody's like, well, I'm going to invest and make as much as I can. I'll give it away. And that's one way to look at it. On the other hand, you go, there are ways to make money and do good as well. In fact, one of the things I always tell people is because people say, well, how do you actually make money and do good? And my response to them is, wait, you mean every time you make money, you're doing something bad? Well, you know, that's crazy.
Yeah.
And so how do you get more and more capital aligned in making the world a better place? And that's not to say that traditional investing, traditional businesses aren't trying to make the world a better place. They are. Mm-hmm. But I think this added extra intentionality of, hey, we're trying to make money because we want to be sustainable and we're trying to make a difference in the lives of these individuals that we invest in. It's just that slight little addition, that slight little twist, I think that gives me real hope. And then to hear, you know, like yourself, hey, if I, a dream for me is to, if I get the resources to go in and to help more children, because they're the next generation. So more and more people with those mindset, I'm very, very encouraged. So thank you very much. We look forward to seeing you a year from now. You know, you've got an open place to stay. Yeah, and we're going to get as many people to come by and buy those baskets from you as we can.
Yes.
And it is, the artistry is beautiful. And we were using your basket just the other day. So it's been a pleasure. So let me, for those of you who are listening, don't forget to subscribe to A New Lens with Common Good Capital on your podcast app of choice. Please rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and Spotify. This will help new listeners find the show and hopefully put them on a path to a more fulfilling portfolio within the impact investing space. Till next time, I'm Jeff Schaefer. John Vier, thanks so much.
Thanks so much.
This podcast is a production of Common Good Capital and does not constitute an offer or a solicitation of an offer. Such offer would only be made through a private placement memorandum. Prospective investors in private placement securities should be aware that making an investment is speculative and involves a high degree of risk, including the risk of losing all or a portion of an investment. Investments of this nature are illiquid and subject to substantial restrictions upon transferability.